Well, back in 1998, the United States House of Representatives did something that had only done once before in its entire history. It impeached the President of the United States of America. President Bill Clinton was impeached on two charges, one of which was perjury, namely that he had lied under oath. Right? He had taken an oath to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And he was being questioned about the Monica Lewinsky scandal, and these were his words under oath to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth. He said, and I quote, "There is no improper relationship between us." Now, later President Clinton admitted that there was an improper relationship between them, but there is not, in other words, the present, there was not an improper relationship. He was asked about that on national television, and here's what he said. When he was asked about his statement where he said there is no improper relationship, these were his words. He was asked about that, and he said this, "Well, it depends on what the meaning of the word is. Because, you see, there wasn't presently an improper relationship, but there was in the past. And so what happened was that he eventually got acquitted, and he got off on a technicality of speech. Well, this is very similar, actually, to what Jesus is dealing with in our passage this morning. Because Jesus is dealing with the people in the scribes and the Pharisees who had developed a plan, a method of getting off and out of commitments, oaths, and lying on technicalities of speech that allowed deceit to creep into their way of life, and they were able to sound very spiritual and be very deceitful at the very same time. And so Jesus is dealing with this in this passage, and I think that actually in many ways we tend to do the same sort of thing. So I want us to notice three things that Jesus teaches us from this passage about oath-taking today. You may come to a passage like this and say, "What in the world? A passage about oath-taking? We don't do that much anymore." Well, you're gonna realize that there are a few occasions where probably all of you have actually taken oaths. But then there are other ways that the principles underneath what Jesus is dealing with here does very much apply to our way of life. Now notice with me the first thing that we see. We're just going to go straight through this passage verse by verse. And I want you to see first of all what Jesus deals with in verse 33. First of all, we see here in this passage the principle of Mosaic law. You remember that in this section of the Sermon on the Mount that we're on in chapter 5, Jesus is dealing with things that they had heard from the Old Testament, maybe even improper interpretations of the Old Testament that they had heard taught to them in synagogue. And then he's combating that by oftentimes taking it up a notch or explaining ways that they weren't in fact keeping the principles of the Old Testament law to begin with. And he does the same thing in verse 33. He says in verse 33 again, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn.'" Now, in this verse, he tips us off to the fact that he's going to be dealing with swearing. So this is a sermon on swearing, on oath-taking, on making vows. And Jesus tells them, he doesn't quote a specific passage of Scripture, but he alludes to several Old Testament texts that deal with the fact that they were not to swear, the Israelites were, they were not to swear falsely. So for example, this is from the Ten Commandments itself. Exodus 20, verse 7. The Lord says, "You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. For the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain." Now, one of the big ways that people took the name of the Lord in vain was by swearing to the Lord an oath or a promise or a commitment and then not following through with it. That was to swear in the Lord's name in a way that is vain. Another passage that alludes to this is Leviticus 19:12, where the Lord says, "You shall not swear by my name falsely and so profane the name of your God, for I am the Lord." This is what Jesus means when he says, "You've heard that it was said, you shall not swear falsely, but perform to the Lord everything that you've sworn." This was a biblical principle. In other words, in this particular instance, Jesus is not quoting this to say that the Pharisees were wrong to say that you should not swear falsely. It was right to not swear falsely, and Jesus wants to point us to that. In fact, we see that oath-taking had a major role, really, in the Old Testament. There are many places that deal with this. I just want to give you a few of them so that you can understand the way they used to do take these oaths in ancient times. In Exodus 22, verses 10 and 11, notice what it says here. This is a situation in which it's actually commanded by God to take an oath in this situation. It says, if a man gives his neighbor a donkey, an ox, a sheep, or any animal to keep for him, so maybe he's going out of town. This is like if you were to leave your dog with a neighbor when you're going out of town. Say, please take care of my dog for me. If he leaves it and it dies, or is hurt, or is driven away while no one is looking, an oath before the Lord shall be made by the two of them that he has not laid hands on his neighbor's property, and its owner shall accept it, and he shall make no restitution. So here's what this means. In other words, you've left your dog at your neighbor's house while you go away on vacation. You come back and your dog is dead. You've given your neighbor specific things. You know, here's what you should do. Here's how much you should feed my dog. Here's how often you should take it out. Outside, and here's what you need to know about the way it sleeps, and here's how you take care of my dog. But when you get back, the dog has died unexpectedly, and you blame your neighbor. And you say, obviously, you did this to my dog. My dog would not have died under my watch, but you have allowed my dog to die. And so then, here's how the Lord tells us to deal with that, okay? So if this happens to you, this is how you can deal with it. He says, look, it's basically your word against theirs. So here's what you do. You bring God into the equation. And you take an oath, both of you, on behalf of your dead dog. And essentially what you're doing is you're saying, God knows what has happened, and may God punish the guilty party. If one of us is guilty for killing this dog. But if I am not guilty of killing this dog, if it died of natural causes or something like this, then God will leave me blameless. And basically, the text says, leave it at that. And that way, if your neighbor goes off the next day and gets hit by a bus or something, you know. You know. He did it. He's guilty. If he goes on and nothing bad happens to him, you know nothing happened. And so this is an example of oath-taking. And actually, it's commanded here. I want you to notice that, because eventually Jesus says, don't swear oaths at all. So we're going to see a tension here between the command to take oaths and Jesus telling us not to. And I'll be honest, I wrestled with this text all week trying to understand what Jesus was saying. I think I made a little headway, and hopefully I can help us put those together. Another example, we won't turn there, but is Numbers 5, verses 19 through 22. And this is an example concerning a wife who is charged with adultery. Similar idea. If a husband begins to think that his wife has committed adultery, and he says, I believe you've committed adultery, she says, no, I haven't. Well, who's to be believed? Maybe he doesn't have the evidence that he needs to charge her with this. So what they do is they take an oath. And the woman takes an oath before God saying, I swear, I take an oath before God Almighty that I have not committed adultery. And then what happens is if something bad happens to her, they know that the Lord is punishing her and that she was in fact lying and that she was guilty. If nothing happens, then she was telling the truth. There's a general expectation even in the Old Testament that people will swear oaths to the Lord. Listen to Deuteronomy 6, verse 13. It says, It is the Lord your God you shall fear, not other gods. Him you shall serve, and by his name you shall swear. This is an example of oath-taking, of taking vows. You are to swear or take vows and oaths not to any of the pagan gods around you, but to the Lord your God alone. Now, after looking, there are many other passages that mention things like this, but after looking at these, I think we can say this about an oath. An oath, if you want to define it, is simply this. It's making a statement and calling God to witness to the truth of that statement and invoking a curse from God if, in fact, you were not telling the truth. It's making a statement and calling God to be the witness, because he sees all things, calling God to be the witness to the truth of that statement, and then invoking a curse down on yourself if, in fact, you're not telling the truth. Now, we do this kind of thing. People will say, I swear to God. And that's what they're doing, in a sense. In a court, we may be sworn in if we're giving testimony, and it says, do you swear? Do you solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? So help you God. And then maybe in a wedding, if you're a married couple today, you know, another word for oath is vow. And so if you were married in a traditional wedding ceremony and the pastor or the one leading the ceremony said, all right, it's time to say your vows to one another. What you're doing when you take a vow is that you're taking an oath. And you're swearing to love this person in good times and in bad, in sickness and in health, till death do us part. This is a vow made before, as the traditional marriage statement goes, made before God and these witnesses, right? That God sees. And what we're doing is essentially what the people in the Old Testament were doing. We're saying, God is witness to this union of this man and woman today. He sees, and may he hold us accountable if we break these oaths, if we break these vows before God and these witnesses. And so oath-taking is something that we actually do in serious times and in solemn situations. And there's two basic principles for proper oath-taking in the Old Testament. One is that oath-taking in the Old Testament was only to be done in God's name. Again, Deuteronomy 6:13, it's the Lord your God that you shall fear, him you shall serve, and by his name you shall swear. Don't swear by any other God's name, and as we'll see in a moment, the Pharisees weren't doing this, don't swear by anything that's not God either. So it's only to be done in God's name, and secondly, it's only to be done in solemn occasions. And in both of these accounts, the scribes and Pharisees had gotten off track. As we'll see in verses 34 through 36, they were not only swearing in the Lord's name. They were swearing to the heavens and the earth and swearing by their head and all kinds. They would swear by anything. But they weren't only swearing in the Lord's name. And then secondly, they were not simply swearing in solemn occasions and making oaths in solemn occasions. They were doing it all the time. As the normal manner of their speech, they would just swear about anything and at any time, in any situation, just to emphasize the fact that they were telling the truth. And both of these are not what the Old Testament is teaching about oaths. We even see examples where people take rash oaths in the Old Testament. That is warned against as well. You remember the story of Jephthah? To me, it's one of the most tragic stories in the book of Judges, which is full of tragic stories. This is a situation in where Jephthah is a man of God. He is anointed as a judge in Israel. And he goes out and he defeats the enemies of God. But listen to this oath that he takes, I assume, in hopes that the Lord will help him in battle. Listen to what he says before he goes out to battle in Judges 11, verses 30 and 31. Jephthah made a vow or an oath to the Lord and said, if you will indeed give the sons of Ammon, the Ammonites, into my hand, then it shall be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the sons of Ammon, it shall be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering. It's a rash oath. You know what happens later in the story? He gets home, he's victorious in war. He gets home, and his daughter steps out of the house first. And true to his oath, true to his vow, he offers her up as a burnt offering to the Lord. That was not a righteous act. That was a rash oath, not done in a proper way, not made in the proper way. So this is what Jesus is dealing with in verse 33. This is the principle of Mosaic law, only in God's name, only for solemn occasions. But the second thing that we see in this text that Jesus teaches us is about the perversion of Jewish tradition. Because you see, the scribes and Pharisees that Jesus is dealing with in this portion of the Sermon on the Mount, they had taken that principle that was good in and of itself from the Old Testament, and they had twisted this oath-taking principle into something that it was never supposed to be. And so we see the perversion of Jewish tradition here. Notice what it says in verse 34. But I say to you, do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king, and do not take an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Now, two things that we see here about the way that the scribes and Pharisees had perverted this law about oaths in the Old Testament. One is that they had developed frivolous oath-taking, frivolous swearing. They would just do it whenever, in any situation, not just for solemn occasions, but just any time. Do you remember when you were a kid and you had an argument maybe out on the playground or with your brother and sister? And you said that you did something, they said you were lying, and how do you prove your innocence? Well, you say, I cross my heart, I hope to die, stick a needle in my eye. What are you doing at that point? This is not a solemn occasion. This is just an everyday circumstance, everyday situation that you're ratcheting up the severity of that situation. And if you think about what you're literally saying, it's ridiculous, isn't it? If I'm lying to you about stealing your Legos, then what I want to happen is that I want you to kill me and stick needles in my eyes. Right? Now, what's happening there when you resort to frivolous oath taking, frivolous swearing in that way, you're making serious situations. You're making a lot of serious situations. So when something actually serious does happen, you have nothing to use to point to the severity of the situation, because you would say the same thing in a lighthearted situation like that, or in a serious situation that you might find yourself in. And so it makes light of the situation that you're in. And this is what these Pharisees and scribes were doing. They would swear about anything. If somebody said something they didn't agree with, they would just start swearing to God and to the heavens and Jerusalem and by this and by that. And the guys were like, whoa, wait a second, I believe you. Okay, you don't have to get that serious about it. So they were involved in frivolous oath-taking. But then another thing that this led to, this perversion of the Old Testament, was a system of acceptable lies. You see, by their frivolous swearing and oath-taking and calling God to witness and using this language to emphasize the truthfulness of their statements, they had developed a whole scheme and system of acceptable lies. For example, this is taken from Jewish literature around Jesus' day. Some of the rabbis argued that if you swore or took an oath by Jerusalem, then you weren't bound to keep your promise. But if you swore or took an oath toward Jerusalem, then you were bound to keep your promise. Sounds a lot like it depends on what the meaning of the word is, right? If you swear by Jerusalem, it's not binding. If you swear toward Jerusalem, it's binding. So what did you do? You could make it sound real serious, and you could heighten your voice, and you could say, I swear by Jerusalem that I will do this and that. But then you say, you didn't catch it, did you? I swore by Jerusalem, not toward Jerusalem. Therefore, I am not held responsible for keeping this oath or this promise that I have made. A little bit like, again, going back to our childhood, crossing your fingers when you say something, right? You make a statement, and then somebody finds out you didn't hold up to it, and you say, but you don't understand. I had my fingers crossed behind my back. Therefore, I am not bound to keep the oath that I've made to you, friend. I have my fingers crossed. Listen to the way that Jesus deals with this later in the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew 23, verses 16 through 22. He deals with oath-taking again, and he uses more examples. The ones he uses in verses 34 through 36 are swearing by heaven, swearing by earth, swearing by Jerusalem, swearing by your own head. Well, Jesus elaborates on it more in Matthew 23. We get a little bit more insight into the way these scribes and Pharisees had perverted the oath-taking ritual. It says in Matthew 23:16, "Woe to you, blind guides, who say, if anyone swears by the temple, it's nothing. You don't have to keep it. But if anyone swears by the gold of the temple, he's bound by his oath." Likewise, verse 17, you blind fools, for which is greater, the gold of the temple or the gold or the temple that has made the gold sacred? And you say in verse 18, if anyone swears by the altar, it's nothing, it's not binding. But if anyone swears by the gift that is on the altar, he is bound by his oath. You blind men, for which is greater, the gift or the altar that makes the gift sacred? So whoever swears by the altar swears by it and by everything on it. And whoever swears by the temple swears by it and by him who dwells in it. And whoever swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits upon it. And so in other words, you could, if you were a Jew in this day, the scribes and Pharisees, they would swear that they were telling the truth by the temple. And then when they found out that they were lying, they would say, I have my fingers crossed. I was swearing by the temple, not by the gold in the temple. And so they had developed this system of acceptable lies. They said, technically, I wasn't lying because of this system, this scale of truth. It wasn't a lie. It was a half-truth. But what Jesus is telling us in this passage is that a half-truth is a whole lie. And any amount of deception that we allow to come into our speech, any amount of deception that makes our speech not perfectly honest and dependable is something that Jesus is teaching against here. You know, there are certain things that I think we do, even in the 21st century, that are deceitful, and yet we think that they're acceptable. We have, don't we, oftentimes, our own little system of acceptable lies. We do this by breaking promises. We do this by exaggerating, you know. That 3-pound bass that you caught last spring becomes a 5-pound bass. That's acceptable because we're just talking about fish, right? Saying, how about this one? Saying, I'll pray for you. Somebody meets you in the hallway. tells you about something that's going on in your life, and your knee-jerk reaction is, I'll pray for you. My guess is that 75% of the time, no prayers ever get offered for in those situations where we say, I'll pray for you. What is this? This is a small example of a system of acceptable lies. If you're a parent and you're dealing with your children, we can have a system of acceptable lies that we accept for ourselves when it comes to their discipline. We'll say, if you do that one more time, you're going to get a spanking. I do it again. Well, two more times, and you're going to get a spanking. What are we doing? We're making our speech meaningless. It means nothing if it's not honest. It means nothing if it's not dependable. We do this through exaggeration. We'll go to the Grand Canyon, and we'll stand and we'll look out over God's handiwork, and we'll say, wow, this is awesome. This inspires awe. And then we'll turn around and buy an ice cream cone and say, wow, this is awesome. And basically our language means nothing at that point. We've come up with a system of acceptable lies, a way for speech to just mean anything we want it to mean. And this is exactly what the scribes and the Pharisees are doing. Maybe we exaggerate a story because we want it to make a deeper impact. There was a man, many of you would probably be familiar with him, as a popular preacher. He was making the rounds of the Southern Baptist Convention, giving his testimony. And his testimony basically said that he was raised as a Muslim and that he was even trained to be a jihadist. And then he was met by a friend at a young age, converted, and became a Christian, left all that behind, and now he's a preacher and evangelist and a church leader and all these kinds of things. And it was a very powerful testimony. And he went, made the rounds, telling people about this amazing testimony. The only problem was, as people began to hear it, they went, and in the age of the internet, you better be sure you don't make claims that are not perfectly true, because they would just Google all the stuff and find out that, in fact, a lot of what he was saying was not true at all. For example, he claimed to have grown up in Turkey when actually he grew up in Ohio. He claimed to be raised in a devout Muslim home when actually it wasn't. He claimed to have been trained as an Islamic jihadist when actually he wasn't. He claims to have had debated dozens of Muslims and Muslim leaders, although there's no evidence of such things. And he was called to account and actually eventually fired from his position because of this. But the rationale is, it will make an impact, maybe even for the kingdom, if I exaggerate a little bit. It'll make people respect me more if I exaggerate a little bit. But what this is a system of acceptable lies. It's a system of deceptive speech that we have justified because the ends justify the means. And this is what the Pharisees were doing in their lives, and this is what the scribes were doing, and this is the greater righteousness that Jesus calls us to, because after all, this is what Jesus is dealing with. In all six of these examples in Matthew 5, 21 through 48, what Jesus is doing is really, he tells us his mission in verse 20. I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you'll never enter the kingdom of heaven. And then he gives us six examples, including this one, in which our righteousness must surpass the scribes and Pharisees. And it involves being honest in our speech as well. So we've seen the perversion of Jewish tradition. Now notice thirdly with me the perspective of Christ's teaching. Christ weighs in on this and he deals with this and teaches us several things here in verses 34 through 37. We see first of all that Christ teaches us really what the Old Testament teaches us, which is that oaths should be reserved for solemn occasions. I say, well, Pastor, it says in verse 34, but I said to you, do not take an oath at all. I understand. I want to show you why I came to this conclusion. I believe Jesus is telling us here that oaths should be reserved for solemn occasions. Now, many in church history have interpreted this to mean that there is absolutely no exception to that rule. So, for example, the Quakers will say that if you are going to give testimony in court, you are forbidden to swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. If you're going to get married, you do not take vows. You maybe make some commitments, but don't take an oath. Don't take a vow, even in those solemn occasions. But here are a few reasons why I don't think that is exactly what Jesus is teaching us. First of all, the oath formulas that Jesus condemns here were those used in ordinary speech, not in the courts. So what Jesus is doing when he says, don't take an oath at all, either by heaven, which is the throne of God, or the earth, because it's his footstool, what he's doing is he is criticizing this way that the scribes and Pharisees were using these oaths in their just general way of speech, in their manner of life. It was just their custom. I mean, almost every conversation would have an oath in it. And so nothing was serious if everything is serious. So Jesus is criticizing that. He's not criticizing the court oaths necessarily. Another reason I don't think Jesus is outlawing all use of oaths is because of these examples throughout the Old and New Testament of righteous people using oaths. For example, God takes oaths. In Hebrews 6:17, listen to what the author of Hebrews says about God taking an oath here. The author of Hebrews says, "So when God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of the promise the unchangeable character of his purpose, he guaranteed it with an oath." Now this would have been a perfect opportunity. This is in the New Testament. This would have been a perfect opportunity for the author of Hebrews to say, "But we're in the new covenant now, and we know that God shouldn't have done that." Right? We don't do that anymore because we're in the new covenant. But he doesn't. In fact, he uses it as a positive example to encourage us with the commitment that God has made to us in his covenant through Christ. Another reason I don't think Jesus is outlawing all use of oaths is because Old Testament saints and New Testament saints use them. For example, Abraham takes an oath in Genesis 14, verses 22 and 23. It says, "Abram said to the king of Sodom, 'I have sworn to the Lord God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take a thread or sandal thong or anything that is yours.'" He swears an oath that he's telling the truth in this solemn occasion. Likewise, David and Jonathan make an oath of friendship. 1 Samuel 20, verse 17 says, "And Jonathan made David swear again by his love for him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul." He swore an oath of friendship. You move on to the New Testament, and you realize this is not just an Old Testament thing. Saints in the New Testament are doing this as well. Paul, on multiple occasions, calls God as a witness to the thing that he's about to say, and in a sense is swearing an oath in doing so, because that's what it means to swear an oath. Listen to 2 Corinthians 1:23 at the words of Paul. Paul says, "But I call God to witness against me." That's exactly what these Old Testament oaths were designed to do. "I call God to witness against me that I did not kill your donkey." Paul is saying, "I call God to witness against me that what I am telling you right now in this letter is true. I call God to witness against me. It was to spare you that I refrained from coming again to Corinth." Likewise, an angel uses an oath in Revelation 10. Listen to verses 5 and 6. "And the angel whom I saw," John is seeing this vision of the angel who's taking him through and showing him things in the spiritual world. "The angel whom I saw standing on the sea and on the land raised his right hand to heaven and swore by him who lives forever and ever, who created heaven and what is in it, the earth and what is in it, and the sea and what is in it, that there would be no more delay." So the angel of God takes an oath. And it wasn't a fallen angel. It was a righteous angel. But then the nail in the coffin to me is that Jesus, in fact, gives testimony under oath in Matthew 26. In Matthew 26, these Jews had arrested him in the Garden of Gethsemane. They bring him to the high priest Caiaphas' home, and he's questioned there. And listen to what it says in Matthew 26, verses 63 and 64. It says, "And the high priest said to him," to Jesus, "I adjure you by the living God." He is calling God to witness against Jesus, the Son of God, that he must give true testimony that he is now, anything Jesus says now is under oath before God. I adjure you by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. Now again, this would have been a perfect opportunity for Jesus to say, we don't do oaths anymore. But notice, Jesus responds under oath and tells the truth to the high priest. Jesus said to him, "You have said so. I am the Christ, Son of God." And he swears in that way under oath of the high priest. So here's what that tells me. What this tells me is that when Jesus says in verse 34, look back at the verse again, when he says, "Do not take an oath at all," and then immediately goes into a description of the ways that the scribes and Pharisees had perverted the process, what he's saying is, don't take oaths at all in the following manner as you're used to hearing them be taken. Jesus says in verse 34, don't take an oath at all, and then immediately, it's a comma, right? Immediately, either by heaven, by earth, Jerusalem, by your head. Don't take oaths like this anymore at all. Don't do this anymore. Don't practice the perverted oath-taking that allows deceit to come into your speech, dishonesty to come into your speech that makes your speech no longer be dependable. So then what is Jesus' point here? If he's not outlawing oaths altogether, I think he's giving us two things. Is this. First of all, everything we say is judged by God. That's what Jesus wants to point out to us here. Everything we say, no matter what formula you use, no matter what system of acceptable lies you have developed for yourself, everything you say is judged by God, who hears and is in reality a witness to everything that comes out of our mouth. That's what he's doing in verses 34 through 36. Notice again, he says, do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, and then what does he do? For it's the throne of God. Now, here's what the scribes and Pharisees were doing. They knew that the Old Testament taught that if you're going to swear an oath, you had to swear it in the Lord's name. So what they said was, we'll swear an oath by something else and then not have to be bound to it. But what Jesus wants to point them out, what he wants to point out to them is this. You can never get away from God, even by ruling him out of your speech. So if you say, I swear an oath to heaven, you're still swearing before God, who is a witness to everything that you say and do. And so that's why he says, if you swear an oath to heaven, you're swearing by the throne of God. That's where God's throne is. You haven't escaped God. You haven't run away from God by ruling him out of your speech. Likewise, verse 35, don't swear by earth. Why? For it is God's footstool. He's connected to everything. And he sees and hears all that you say. Don't swear by Jerusalem, for it's the city of the great king. That's a reference to God as well. God hears, even when you swear, scribes and Pharisees, by Jerusalem. He hears that. He's the great king of Jerusalem, and he hears. And you will not go unpunished if you're deceitful, even when you swear to Jerusalem. And then the last one is in verse 36. Don't take an oath by your head. And here, what his explanation is, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Now, this was before the day of hair dye. Okay? So you got to understand that. But Jesus is saying, look, you can't control even your head. Don't swear by yourself, because you can only even control yourself. Who can make your hair white or black? God can. God's in control. You name it, anything you swear by, ultimately, God is still a witness to whatever it is you're saying. And the principle here is everything, not just some things, like the scribes and Pharisees wanted to believe so that they could get out of their commitments. Everything you say, everything you commit to, everything you promise, everything you do is done before the all-seeing eye of the holy and righteous God. And then the second principle he's teaching us is that our speech should always be honest and dependable. Our speech should always be honest and dependable. And what this means is that in terms of our everyday speech, I mean, unless you're in court giving testimony or saying marriage vows or in some very solemn ceremony or occasion, our everyday speech should be what in verse 37? Yes. Yes, yes. No, no. No frivolous swearing. No frivolously heightening our language to make people believe us even when we're telling a lie. We should just say yes and mean yes. Say no and mean no. Anything more than this comes from evil. Another way to translate that is comes from the evil one, who is the father of what? It's the father of lies. The father of deceit. The first person to ever twist language and come up with an acceptable system of lying was Satan himself. Did God really say you shouldn't eat from any tree? It's not what he said. Don't eat from that tree. Not any tree, that tree. Words matter. And this is an acceptable speech that is deceptive. And Jesus calls us, rather, to be honest and to be dependable. And the fact of the matter is, if we're honest and dependable with people, we won't have to swear anyway, will we? Because our yes will mean yes, and our no will mean no. I would encourage you to evaluate all the different walks of your life. If you're a parent, the way you talk to your children. If you're a child, the way you deal with and speak to your parents. As fellow church members, the way we speak to one another. The promises and commitments we make as we've joined this church and committed to do certain things for and with one another. Do not make those commitments, any commitment in life, lightly. Make them with a sense of solemnity, of being solemn and serious, and understanding that the commitments I make now, God will hold me accountable for forever. Wise, honest, dependable speech. This is what Jesus is calling for in this sermon.